Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Andy, Don, and Dude.
We're in trouble, and that goes double. It's the Album Nerds Podcast. Hi, dude. I got Andy and Don with me. Are you gentlemen ready to double down on some records?
When my dog goes to the bathroom, that's what we call it.
You know, when he, double down.
When he goes number two. Yeah. Did he double down? Yep.
Hopefully you don't have any stinkers on the show today, but...
Yeah, it's going to be a good week. So this is the Album Nerds Podcast. We love the album format, music, records. We love talking to ourselves, to each other, and to y'all. So we've got a great show for you. If you haven't guessed already, we're going to be talking about double albums. So we're each going to bring a double album and try and wade through the deep, deep waters that brings. We're also going to have Don ask us a deep question. Then we're going to give some shout outs to album related items we're digging. And then at the very end, we'll spin the wheel of musical discovery to find out what we'll talk about next time. But this week, we're going to
double up. That's what I'm talking about.
Well, the earliest double albums were often in the world of classical music, as many pieces were too long for the standard LP length of 44 minutes. Then many live recordings were released as double albums in order to include the entire performance. One of the first examples consisting of new studio recordings is 1956's Ella Fitzgerald Sings the Cole Porter Songbook.
That's a double long title as well.
Yes, it is. Bob Dylan's Blonde on Blonde, released in 1966, is widely considered to be one of the first double albums in popular music with complete original recordings by the artist. Since then, many more double albums have come. Today, each of us will present a double album.
Yeah, so it seems like a pretty simple task. And then you start listening to double albums and realize just how freaking bogged down you can get.
Messy.
It's much harder to communicate whatever the artist is trying to communicate. And hopefully the double album is the way to communicate that better, right? So it's a deep, 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 deep pool. How'd you guys do? Drown? Doggy paddle? Breaststroke? I mean, how you doing?
I found a few things to preserve my life on. I'll mention a couple, as we like to do. The one I've been singing the most in my head, honestly, I almost wish I picked it. The Clash's London Calling. Mm. Classic, classic album. So much fun to listen to, going back to just such a good variety of songs, and they're all really high quality. Another one we'll have to get to very soon on the show here, Sonic Youth, Daydream Nation, one of my all-time favorites. Fits that double format really well. I think they make use of it with their lengthy song runtimes in an interesting way. An album I've tried to get into over the years, never really stuck to me before. I did enjoy it quite a bit more this time around. Tupac's All Eyes on Me, maybe after listening to Freddie Gibbs on the show a couple weeks ago, that Tupac vibe kind of got under my skin a little bit.
Cool.
Double Pac.
Yes, exactly. Tupac's a Tupac. Yeah.
Probably comes as no surprise to anybody that, you know, one of my first thoughts was Pink Floyd, The Wall, you know, very famous double album from 1979. Also, Stevie Wonder, Songs in the Key of Life. You know, we've done a couple of his records, and I think one of these days we'll have to do that one because that's a good one. And then Smashing Pumpkins, Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness. I feel like you guys did it on a previous episode before
Many
Dawn.
Moons ago.
Yeah. Yeah, I could probably use a refreshed conversation.
Yeah. How about you, dude?
So I never really thought of Prince 1999 as a double album, but it is. It is two LPs, and that's probably his funkiest album. I was pretty close on that, but we have done so much Prince, even more than the artists I'm bringing up today. So I held back. Bob Dylan's Blonde on Blonde. Good album. I mean, you know, classic Dylan, mostly have it here on the list so that I can do this when I talk about it. There's not enough of that on the show.
Yeah, there might be.
And then I did get pretty into this album, Husker Du, Zen Arcade. Husker Du, Husker Don't. It's up to you, but it is a good record, kind of a punkish, post-punk, kind of the birth of alternative rock sound.
Yeah, very influential.
But good stuff.
Was it Bob Mould from Nebraska? Because it's a Husker.
I don't think so.
Yeah, the corn Huskers would sound cooler, I think.
The corn Huskers.
All right. So that's enough of that. Why don't we get into the albums we actually picked?
You choose me?
Would you be a musician if nobody ever heard you?
Sure.
Why?
Because I love music. It's in my head. I can't get it out.
Do you listen?
Yeah.
You're hearing it yourself.
I hear it now.
Not a singer. Although, could have been good.
And of course, there's the acclaimed vocalist, Miles Davis. Now, acclaimed trumpeter, jazz musician, Miles Davis. We're going to be talking about his 1970 breakthrough album, Bitches Brew. This is a double album. It's a very lengthy, coming in at an hour and 45 minutes. It was among Davis's highest charting albums in the U.S., and he ended up winning a Grammy for Best Large Jazz Ensemble for the record. This record is notable for a couple components. It marked kind of a shift in Davis's production, moving towards like a more electronic sound, or more electric sound, I guess you'd say. He uses some electric piano and guitar pretty heavily on this record, and that became a big thing into the 70s and 80s for him. It's also a notable record for use of studio engineering, and there's a lot of interesting cuts and studio wizardry used on the record. All right, why don't we jump in and play the title cut? This is a little tiny smattering of Bitches Brew.
Not entry-level jazz.
I wasn't kidding myself. We were jumping in the deep end right out of the gate today. Challenging record to listen to. Super curious to hear what you guys thought. That track there coming in at about 27 minutes, following up after a 20-minute opening cut. They're both pretty experimental, both pretty loose. A lot of tempo shifts, a lot of instruments involved. Yeah, my clickbait headline for this album is Davis drinks album nerd under the table. This record's always a little bit overwhelming for me. I love it. This is one of those really influential records for me that kind of got me into jazz and made me realize, like, you know, there's elements of like progressive rock and, mm-hmm. and other things, psychedelia that I can appreciate here. But there's also a lot of really crazy ideas that only jazz can really explore, I think. But it's tough. It's a tough listen.
It seems like production was at a higher importance level here than on many other jazz albums that tend to just be, it is what it is. This feels like it had some tweakage, you know, some thoughtful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little more intention behind how it was edited. And like I was saying, there's a lot of a kind of effects here, like studio wizardry. Usually you think of a jazz album as being kind of like a live recording of just like what happened at the moment.
Yeah.
This is that, but also something else. Yeah, there's another layer to it. All right, why don't we dig into a little bit of that opening cut? This is probably the most challenging track on the record. It's called Pharaoh's Dance.
I think we used to play that in junior high school band.
Intentionally or just sounded kind of
Well, they'd pass blunts around the band room first, and then we'd play
it. Junior high, damn it.
Yeah, it's the only way to get in the right mood for that, dude.
So that little clip you heard there featured Benny Maupin on bass clarinet. Like that sound, the bass clarinet.
Yeah.
Although I have trouble differentiating between the bass clarinet and the bassoon. Very similar.
Many do.
I thought it sounded kind of sexy a little bit too. In two, both ways.
I think everything sounds sexy.
So Pharaoh's Dance was the composition credit actually goes to Joe Zawinul, who's the one of the electric keyboardists that perform on this record. So that starts off the album, 20 minutes and 7 seconds.
That's a good size bite.
Yeah, a lot to digest. My clickbait headline is Davis perfects the call of the Canada Goose on Bitches Brew. So the first clip we heard, the trumpet with the reverb on it, reminds me of a goose flying. Of course, we have so many geese around. I just know that sound.
The working title of this album was "The Goose Is Loose."
So, as I've said before, I'm certainly a jazz beginner, and this is a lot. So
this is like giving a kindergartner, like asking a kindergartner to write a dissertation.
Yeah, this is like calculus for, you know. So, I was overwhelmed at first, but, I actually did warm up to it pretty quickly. I guess because I listened to a lot of like early Floyd and even like the Velvet Underground. So I've been exposed to that kind of avant-garde noise and stuff. So that wasn't really off-putting to me. I guess as I, am learning to appreciate jazz, I'm interested in how I'm supposed to listen to it or how I'm supposed to process it. So what I did this time around was kind of look for order in the chaos, because all of these tracks are just chaotic and there's so many instruments going on. There's two bass players, two drummers. But so like I would start by trying to find the beat in there. And it's not always in the obvious place, because the drums are so busy doing like other things. So, once I could kind of identify the rhythm of the track, it kind of helped me to, see where the other pieces fit in. I actually didn't find it that cumbersome. I think because it's fewer tracks or something, there's fewer songs.
Too heavy, too light, too black or too white. That's a cumbersome reference.
Sounds like a 90s rock joke in here.
You can't say cumbersome without thinking about Seven Mary Three. I'm sorry.
But because there's fewer tracks to keep track of. It didn't seem quite as long as some of the other records we were listening to. But really interesting experience.
It's cool. Well, I appreciate you guys trying it out with me. Let's play another cut from the record here. I think this one is one that really dives into some of that jazz fusion I was talking about.
Yeah.
Really incorporating elements of guitar rock into jazz. This is Miles Runs the Voodoo Down.
Yeah, so that song is, it just feels a little more Miles forward, I guess, with the trumpet being more present, even when it's just kind of fading there throughout. Groovy and hypnotic, funky bass line, rhythmic beats, those effects come into play a lot on this track. The thing that I found most interesting, and this has been alluded to, is the people that worked on this song. We've got two drummers, one in the right channel, one in the left channel, doing their own thing. Bass players, two of them, doing their own thing. And so if you're listening on headphones or whatever, and you're hearing the drums, it's two different guys playing drums, one in each ear. It's just...
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
That's crazy to me. So not only was it studio wizardry, but not through production tricks, but through recording tricks. And that's pretty cool.
Good point.
My clickbait headline to describe the album, Miles Davis' Mental Road Trip and How Bitches Brew Blew Our Minds and Changed Jazz Forever.
Forever.
I need a higher IQ to fully process this, but the way I kind of viewed it was being on a cross-country road trip or in a train, and stuff's just whizzing by you, so these sounds are just happening as you're listening to this record. But occasionally something catches your eye, you kind of move your head and you see it for longer, when the stuff isn't whipping past you. So these moments pop out, and every time you listen, it's a different moment that pops out. So I try not to think too much about what anything means or what the emotions are, but just looking for the moments each time.
I think that's a good point. I think trying to make sense of it is this going to end up hurting your brain? But I think if you can just, I think paying attention to it and trying to make sense of it are different. I think mm-hmm. this record does demand your attention. It doesn't work super well in the background.
No.
But I think trying to figure out the logic behind it maybe is just an exercise in futility.
But it's cool. I mean, it just sounds cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that's Miles Davis. He sounds pretty cool. Well, like I was saying, for me, this really is a landmark record, and I think you can draw a lot of what would happen in jazz and funk and rock in the 70s, kind of back to this moment in 1970. So with that in mind, I'm going to nominate this for the Album Nerds Hall of Fame. What do you guys think?
You know, again, I'm still a jazz beginner, but I mean, this album seems important. Also, it's daring, I think. It reminds me of like Dylan, you know, agitating all the folkies, you know, when he went electric. And I think at the time, you know, jazz had a certain snobbery about it, and they were resisting these rock and roll urges, and he didn't fear that. So I vote yes.
Yeah, the brew, the recipe for this album with all the different players and all the different personalities and sounds and all of it just swirling together, turning your brain into mush. That takes something special, right? For an album with really basically no words to blow your mind in some way, to just be like puzzled and intrigued. So yeah. I'm going to say that brew is magical and it casts a spell on me. So yes.
All right. Well, congratulations to Miles and all the fabulous genius musicians who are involved with this recording. Welcome to the Album Nerds Hall of Fame.
Thank you very much.
Sorry. I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me.
If you're enjoying the show, and we hope you are, do us a solid and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Maybe we made you laugh, or you discovered an album you enjoy. Leaving a review keeps the show going and helps other music fans find us.
Most double albums in the past have been generally bad because people can't seem to write enough good material for a double album. But there are exceptions, and I think that what we've done is an exception.
All right. My pick for a double album is The Cure's Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me, released in May 1987.
They missed an opportunity here. It should have been Kiss Me, Kiss Me as a double album, not a triple.
That's true.
Right? I mean, okay.
So this is the seventh studio album by the English rock band formed by guitarist, vocalist, and songwriter Robert Smith in Crawley, West Sussex in 1978. This is the second album to feature kind of this core band lineup that basically took them from The Head on the Door all the way through Wish. Poral Thompson on guitar, Simon Gallup on bass, Boris Williams on drums, and Lawrence Tallhurst on keyboards, formerly the drummer. So unlike previous albums, Robert invited each of the members to contribute song ideas. And I guess each of them, you know, brought, you know, five or six demos. And I think that's why he ended up with, you know, so much material for this album. Let's hear, you know, one of the classic Cure songs, Just Like Heaven. It's really hard to pick clips for these albums because there's so many songs, and it's not like there's one song that encapsulates the you know, the whole album. But yeah, Just Like Heaven, Robert Smith has acknowledged over the years that it's one of the best songs, or maybe the best song he has written. Really is a, you know, I think a perfect pop song. It's melodic and catchy, simple chord progressions, but it has like this dreamy vibe, kind of thoughtful lyrics.
Yeah, the sad synths that The Cure is so good at.
Yeah.
Take the poppiness and just whittle it down just enough to give it that nice mix.
But there's also like this joy in his voice, though. You can like really feels like he's excited about this person. Yeah. Like I just appreciate that about him. The range in his voice is very dynamic.
He's just anticipating how much they're going to hurt him in the future so they'll have material for his next album. Yeah. That's why he's so happy.
The song actually uses that old music trick where you're sort of introducing the instruments one at a time. You know, it starts out with a drum fill in the bass, and then you've got, you know, a little guitar, and then the 12-string guitar, then all of a sudden the keyboards come in, and then it's that, you know, melodic lead guitar line. Yeah, very, very effective. So my clickbait headline is Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me delivers the story of The Cure on two discs. So it really does show kind of all the sides of The Cure, you know, from throughout their career. So you've got real dark tracks, you know, like The Kiss and The Snake Pit that are reminiscent of what they were doing on Pornography. You've got pop tracks like Just Like Heaven and Why Can't I Be You and Hey You. You've got the more psychedelic moments like If Only Tonight We Could Sleep. And then, you know, Shiver and Shake kind of has like a Three Imaginary Boys post-punk sound. So there's just so much here. I mean, it's not the most coherent collection of songs. I don't know. That's kind of its charm, I think, is as well. It's just a lot of a lot of a lot of different a lot of different right. things. So, right. Well, let's hear the opening cut. This is The Kiss.
So that's like a 6 minute song, and the vocals don't start till 3:50 or so. So to open your double album that way, I think is pretty gutsy.
Just pulling your guts out on the floor, right?
Yeah. Well, it does set this creepy tone for it, which there are moments that we step away from that a little bit, like with Just Like Heaven, but it kind of makes The Kiss, which you'd think is going to be some super romantic kind of thing, and it's more about the poison kiss and the kiss of death and
The dark side of the kiss.
Yes. It's about love, but the harmful nature of the connection. You know, and that's what The Cure does so well. I mean, I think that's why their name fits so much. Like there's this constant hurt for Robert Smith and his band. His music is The Cure, right? Because that sadness feeds it. So I don't know. I was thinking about that. Yeah. You know, the clickbait headline that I chose for this album: "Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me." 18 tracks for when you're feeling dramatic and in need of a musical embrace. Dark and poppy with enough emotion to sustain. The album has a nice flow and feels like an album. Even though it's a double, it doesn't feel overwhelmingly like stuff doesn't belong. So it works. It works as a double album for me. Even at the midpoint, The Snake Pit, although this one's very kind of bleak and sort of simplified. But I find it to be a kind of a good bridge between those two sounds throughout the album. But it just kind of, everything just kind of worked for me.
It's interesting because, I mean, there are these two distinct sounds or sides to the band on the record, but they're kind of mixed together and throughout the track list. So you don't really get, here's a dark side, here's a light side.
Yeah.
It's kind of an up and down, in and out of the light sort of feeling as you go throughout it.
Yeah. Really since the 1984 album, The Top, most Cure albums kind of follow this model where they're kind of up and down. I mean, the only exceptions would be like Disintegration and Blood Flowers, which were both kind of more coherent. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Robert likes to take you on that kind of roller coaster ride.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear another one. This is Shiver and Shake.
So chaotic.
Yeah.
Really like that one.
It's like a real punk rock energy to that track. I guess I didn't associate with them to this degree. I found pretty interesting. Don, you probably know. Is that, I'd read that that's maybe about the keyboardist / former drummer Lowell Thurst, who was struggling with addiction at the time.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And this is a time when, you know, Tallhurst's contributions to the group were becoming less and less, you know, because of his, you know, because of his addictions and stuff. And I've actually heard that the band, you know, they were pretty mean to him.
That's what it sounded like, yeah.
You know, just and very dismissive of him. And so, you know, I think they've expressed regret about how they treated him at the time.
All right, so my clickbait headline for this album is Smith and Company open wide and firmly plant a sloppy smack of creativity. For me, I think this record is pretty interesting. I really enjoy that sort of rich, dark texture that they do create with the guitar sound and the keyboards and stuff here. I've always loved that about their sound in general. I think it's a really, I mean, it fits the moody vibe that I think they're going for really well. And it brings like that darkness and that sort of fear around love, I guess, is always kind of how I picture The Cure. you know, like so many of these double albums that we've explored here, like there's just the excess, you know, sometimes you get lost in like just having so much. I like that track there, the Snake Pit. For me, it really didn't work at all and kind of just the album kind of went off the tracks a little bit at that point for me.
Wrong.
But then you have, you know, these like super catchy songs that are just undeniably good. And there's other interesting moments like Icy and Sugar, I found to be pretty cool. Probably my favorite cut on the album is Hot, 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 which I think has like maybe my favorite Robert Smith vocal performance on it, where he's just kind of like all over the place. Sounds like he's having a great time. I mean, it's just super fun.
I just feel like Anthony Kiedis is supposed to start rapping right now, you know what I mean? It's so uncured.
It's a funky song. Yeah. Really, really good time listening to that track.
Yeah, that took me aback, that track.
That was a single, right? I feel like I heard that on the radio.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, overall, the album, I think, is really interesting, and I would count it among my favorite Cure albums, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so many great songs on here. You know, it's not my favorite Cure album, I think, just because I think I prefer sort of the more coherent approach of like Faith and Pornography and Disintegration. But I do think that kind of makes this album special. You know, just it is like, it's their double album and it is just a mishmash of, you know, diverse approaches.
Well, was he right? Like the little bit at the top when he said that they did it right for a double album. Do you guys think that they did? I do.
Yeah, I do too.
I don't know. I think they could have structured it better. Just to make me feel more intentional.
I can't name any tracks to cut, I guess, is what I'm saying.
I can name three.
What is this? Name that tune? I could cut this album by three tracks.
Would it be better as a 60-minute album, or is it better at like about an hour and a half?
I don't know. It's so hard to go back and think that, though, you know, because this is how I know this album is this giant double thing. Yeah. You know,
it's new to me, and it didn't overwhelm me with its doubleness. Like it just felt like a record, it just felt like an album. So I think that's kind of where I'm coming from. So often they're overwhelming and unnecessary, but I didn't feel like anything was unnecessary. So,
well, what do you think? Let us know. It's The Cure's Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me from 1987.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
And now, deep questions by Don. So, you know, of course, we're going, you know, double as deep this week. I guess you could make the case that some double albums are just maybe too much of a good thing. What are some other examples of things being too much of a good thing?
Yes. Good question, Don. That's a deep one. I'm feeling the depth.
That pinches a little.
The first thing I thought of was Disney and the Marvel and Star Wars things. Yeah, they've become so much in the last 15 years. There's too much of that, in my opinion. And the quality has suffered significantly.
Everything they do is so, like, even the Disney cartoons are all so formulaic. It's the same characters, but it's different animals and different voice actors. But it's the same story over and over.
Yeah. And that got me thinking about just, like, you know, how the internet in general is organized and how we're fed content through these different systems. And thinking about, like, YouTube. When I watch something on YouTube, if I search for something, heaven forbid, and then the next 3 weeks, I get all these videos about, you know, fixing door creaks or something like that forever.
Yeah. So. You only need one door creak video. You know what I'm saying?
I was good on that one. Yeah. The first one was
good.
They
need to start asking, did this solve your problem? You click yes, and then they do not
remove it.
Algorithm.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, everything in our lives like that. I mean, even like the news articles that get thrown to me every day, like, start to form a pattern after a period. And I don't know if that's really good.
Yeah.
So, how about you, dude?
I love American football very much. I look forward to it every year, but it's just sometimes it's a little too much, especially later in the season. I mean, there's so many games. There's Thursday nights, Monday nights, Sunday nights, all day Sunday. Yeah. There's fantasy football. I'm in several leagues. There's pick 'ems. Yeah. And by the mid-season, late season, especially depending on how I'm doing in my fantasy leagues, I start to be like, okay, I'm not even going to do red zone today. Can we take a break? You know, like I start to get a little burned out because I'm so into it at the top and it's a lot of months. So sometimes by the end, I'm relieved it's over. But then by March, I'm already doing research for the next season. So
dying for the draft. Now, the NFL has really stretched out this schedule. If you know, it's like you said, every night is almost something different now.
Yeah, well, I might offend some listeners here.
Wouldn't be the first time.
But I was thinking about like music festivals. You know, like I can go to a show and, you know, I'm good for about, you know, 3 hours of music. I think even if it was Depeche Mode, The Cure, and Pink Floyd or something all in the same show, like I don't know if I could do a day of music. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Also, like the 3 day festival is like just overkill.
Yeah. I was also thinking about like, you know, collecting objects like records, for example. You know, like I've I know that I've you know, I was collecting vinyl for a while, and then like during the pandemic all of a sudden I was doing like baseball cards, and it's like after you get a certain amount of them, then it's like, what am I going to do with these, you know? And then you have to allocate a space in your home, and then if you ever move, you've got to move it. It's just, I don't know, it's too much. And then finally, podcasts, right? I think some I won't mention any names, but you know, some podcasts are just too long. Not this one, of course. and some of them, you know, some of them are like daily, and they don't need to be daily. If you're somebody that listens to lots of podcasts, you know, it can become too much.
I know, but the dailies a lot of times come down to personality of the hosts. So many times when I listen to a daily podcast, usually about football, it's because I like the people doing it. So it's, you know, when I'm exercising or whatever, it's like hanging out with my buddies. Yeah. I think it just depends on why you're listening to the podcast, whether or not it's like this one to get great insights about albums and join us.
Right.
Clearly.
Well, is the Album Nerds podcast too much of a good thing? Let us know, Instagram and Facebook, or leave a comment on our website, albumnerds.com.
Yeah, because it's double and there's tons of stuff, and I wrote a lot of good shit on that. You know, I like all the stuff I did on that, mainly.
Yeah, so I'm going with the Beatles. Self-titled, although commonly known as the White Album. It's probably one of the most well-known double albums, one of the earliest of the rock and roll era.
Mm-hmm.
And the Beatles, English rock band formed in Liverpool in 1960. John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, Ringo Starr. Influential, yada, yada, yada. George Martin, producer that helped them experiment and really shape their sound in the studio. This album came out November 22nd, 1968. Why don't we listen to a little bit of While My Guitar Gently Weeps?
We must show.
So this is George Harrison's first song on the White Album, which I believe is 30 tracks. Is that correct, guys?
Yes, it is 30.
Yeah. Oy. So apparently the song was inspired by a random phrase that George Harrison found in a book. He recorded it on his own, but didn't really like how it was sounding, so he got Eric Clapton, his buddy, involved.
It's nice when you can just call up Eric Clapton and be like, hey, help me out with this song.
Yeah, I feel like this is possibly the best song on the album, but definitely when George Harrison, that sound that went on into his solo career really started to get established. It's
really great.
So moody and beautiful.
Yeah,
and I look forward to it every time I listen to the record.
Yeah, it's a song I've appreciated more and more over the years.
Yeah. I've always wondered why so many musicians cover it, but I've come to understand why that is. It's pretty beautiful. Yeah.
So the clickbait headline I chose for this album, The Beatles in Stereo, the eclectic opus unveiled in four sides and four personalities, and the beginning of the end. This album was fractured in a lot of ways. I mean, they were all contributing their own stuff. John and Paul in particular were hogging most of the space on the album. They weren't even all involved in all of the songs. A lot of it was Ringo on drums, Paul doing his thing. They just weren't much of a band at this point. A lot of the songs were written on a trip they took to India to visit the Maharishi and, you know, get spiritual. But I feel like this is a product of separation. And it feels like it now as an adult. I used to love this album just because of the varied nature of all the songs, but now it makes me a little sad.
Yeah. Just because of that disorder among the group.
Yeah, that they weren't really a band. You know, they were slowly ceasing to be a band. I mean, this was 68, and then there was Abbey Road and Let It Be. Those are the last two albums, and that was by 1969 or 70. The whole thing was over, and they so this is like a it's like they were getting ready for their solo careers in some ways, you know, preparing.
Yeah. On the other hand, though, I think the fact that they're all sort of individually working, you know, there's less of the group magic. You know, I think there's some magic in each of the members, you know, kind of having the opportunity to work on their own. And I think there's some excitement in the music because of that.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of like interesting little experiments that maybe you wouldn't have gotten on a certainly a smaller record, but even a record that was more cohesive.
Some of them that weren't even really finished sounding to me now. And I think, you know, George Martin wanted this, the producer wanted it to be one disc album and cut out some of the stuff, but the Beatles did not want it that way. So one of the things, they also recorded different versions of songs for this. Why don't we listen to a little bit of Revolution One?
For people with minds that hate, but all I can tell you is, brother, you have to wait.
When, you know, my dad would play this record when I was a kid, and I always found this version very not what I wanted. I wanted the single version, the one that's like more raucous.
Yeah, this has the shooby-doo-wop and sounds a little dated.
I'm kind of annoyed that that isn't on here too. They put Revolution 9 on here, but they couldn't put...
Is that just Revolution, the one that's on like the radio?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just
Revolution Zero or something?
Yeah. What is this, a soft drink?
You know, I was kind of impressed at the level-headedness of the lyrics on that song, especially given the time period. It's not really, I mean, I always think of the band, the Beatles, as being very, you know, anti-war, kind of pacifist people. But I think the song itself kind of promotes a more balanced message on the social issues at the time, which was always kind of cool.
Yes.
My clickbait headline for this album is, "Even when the boys make a mess, it turns into something great." This is a messy album for sure, but you can't deny that these guys are just, you know, at their creative peaks, and they're all incredibly talented, doing some really interesting things, and that's, you know, 30 tracks of genius is still 30 tracks of genius. So I think it's pretty hard to deny that as going through the tracks here, even if they're all very different and feel like kind of
disjointed,
schizophrenic listening to this, but it's still, the quality is undeniable.
Yeah, it's more a collection of experiments and songs and less a true album. I think they just wanted to get it all out.
But there's also something like charming to like the imperfections and the unfinished quality to a lot of this. It feels like a little more intimate and personal in that way than maybe some of their more polished records.
And they tried some weird stuff too, like Helter Skelter, for instance, which is sometimes called one of the first heavy metal songs. I don't quite take it that far, but
it's pretty rocking. Yeah, we'd say it was metal. But.
Motley Crue thought so. So yeah, I mean, they definitely went in whatever direction they felt like. So that is the freedom, and probably the if there was one theme of this album, it's freedom, creative freedom.
Totally agree.
All right, so why don't we jump to another track, something a little lighter but very memorable, "Obla Di Obla Da."
I can't listen to that one without bombing my head.
Yeah.
So "Obla Di Obla Da" is a McCartney song, one of several that Lennon would dismiss as kind of Paul's granny music. I didn't know this until recently. "Obla Di Obla Da," "Life Goes On, Brah," was reportedly an expression used by Nigerian conga player Jimmy Scott Omukpor, who was, I guess, an acquaintance of McCartney. So McCartney borrowed that expression from him, and I think the guy actually wanted to get songwriting credit for it, and I think they ended up making a deal over it. So supposedly it's a tribute to like kind of Jamaican ska music, but I never picked that out before. It always seemed more like a hootenanny or something to me than
it's like ska like on crack, like it's twice as fast as it should be. Yeah. If it's going to be a ska song.
Yeah, I get it now.
You know, it's there.
Actually, I heard this news report a few years ago. The Max Planck Institute in Germany, these researchers declared that it's the most perfect pop song ever. Well, the quote is, "Songs that we find pleasant strike a good balance between us knowing what is going to happen next and surprising us with something we did not expect." So for some reason, this chord sequence or whatever is that right balance of kind of expecting something that's going to come and being surprised. So it's it's objectively the best pop song of all time.
That's funny, because I had read that it was the most hated Beatles song of all time.
That too. Right, well, my clickbait headline is White Album delivers too much of the band you can't get enough of. I think it is... It's a great album. I think similar to like Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me, like I know it as a double album.
Yeah.
And it's kind of special because it's a double album and it's a lot of different approaches. So it's charming in that way, and it makes it stand out from the rest of the Beatles catalog.
Yeah. I used to be kind of dismissive of the Paul McCartney stuff when I was college age. I was all about, Happiness is a Warm Gun, Continuing Story of Bungalow Bill, I'm So Tired.
The Lennon songs?
Yeah. But, now I really do appreciate what Paul McCartney was, that folksiness that he was bringing, the balance that he brought to the Beatles. And then as a solo artist, he carried on and found a way to kind of balance it himself. But why don't we do it in the road? I mean, apparently McCartney saw some dogs or something humping in the road. Yeah. Monkeys. He saw monkeys.
Monkeys.
Huh? Yeah, in the street. Probably in India.
That's really, that really kicks ass, especially where it's put on the record. I think it's pretty
well, weird. It's so close to Julia, right?
Yeah.
And my dad told me a story when he was like high school age. His parents didn't like the Beatles, and he got the White Album and wanted to play Julia for his mom to show her how nice they are.
Uh-huh.
But he accidentally put on "Why Don't We Do It in the Road," and he's like, "Oh, wrong cut." She's like, "Oh no, let's listen to this one."
Well, Julia is a beautiful track.
Yes.
That's kind of how the album goes. Like you were saying earlier, like from track to track, you can kind of satiate different desires almost, instantly. Like within a couple minutes, you get something totally different.
Well, how powerful is a band when they can rewrite the classic song used to celebrate people's birthday?
Yeah.
Happy birthday's out the window. They write a birthday song that has become a standard.
That's one of the few songs written by John and Paul, right?
Yep. 50-50, supposedly. But poor Ringo, right? I mean, what, did he get two tracks?
Well, hey, Don't Pass Me By, I think, is a pretty decent song.
Yes, yeah. And that's his first, songwriting credit, I think, in the Beatles catalog.
But that guy must have just been a patient, dedicated dude. Although he did quit during the making of this album. He was gone for a couple of weeks.
But imagine how bad it was if Ringo was quitting.
Yeah.
He's the guy's in my meal ticket. Come on.
Yeah. I remember on that Get Back documentary or Let It Be or whatever, he just seemed just the coolest guy.
Yeah. What do you need me to do? Let's do it.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Well, you need that in a group like this. Yeah. I mean, all these big personalities.
Okay. So, we could probably do an hour and a half on this album alone, maybe even longer, or a series of 20 podcast episodes daily, but it's a groundbreaking album. It's a classic, especially among double albums. So I'm going to nominate this for the Album Nerds Hall of Fame. I wish we could have gone over all the tracks, but this is a must listen. If you want to get to know the Beatles as individuals, except for poor Ringo, you could quickly do so by listening to this album. What do you guys think?
No, I'm 100% on board with what you're saying. And I don't think it's my favorite Beatles record, but I do think it's probably one of the more interesting listens, like you were saying, to get the personalities. So, definite yes for me.
Don, what about you?
Yes, definitely. Or it's the first example of a double album I can think of.
It is the double album.
It is the double album, I suppose. All right, so that was the Beatles' White Album. Welcome to the Album Nerds Hall of Fame.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
So we've been listening to very, very long albums over the past couple of weeks. Did you find any time to listen to anything else?
Good question. I know Andy always finds time.
Yeah, I always can make time for new releases. That's what I do on my Fridays. So I got, you know, I did something a little different this week. I thought there's so many good new releases out. I thought maybe I'd try to find one for each of you, my co-hosts here. So I picked out one for both of you. The first one I got up here is something I thought maybe Don would appreciate. Probably not, but I'll give it a shot. This is a British synth pop group by the name of Elbow. They have a new album called Audio Vertigo.
I could give it a shot.
It's got all the elements, right?
Yeah.
The critics are into it. I am less so, but I thought I'd at least pass it on to you before I take it out of my Spotify collection. And for you, dude, I thought I'd mention the new Mark Knopfler record, One Deep River. This is from the former Dire Straits frontman.
Kind of sounds a little country. Is that the case throughout here? It's a little more folky and...
Yeah, a little folksy Americana vibe for sure. Yeah.
Well, he sounds good. His voice sounds really good.
Yeah.
He actually did an album with Emmylou Harris many years ago that was pretty good.
Cool.
Kind of in the same vein.
Yeah. I think he's, well, I don't know if that's underrated, but I was enjoying his stuff.
So what would you, did you do for yourself too, or just for us?
Yeah, I got one for myself. One of my favorite metal groups from the last decade or two, High on Fire, have a new album out called Cometh the Storm. This is a Matt Pike sludge metal project. Super heavy, super stoner. Love it.
I always forget to look for them, but I always enjoy their stuff.
Yeah, they're pretty rocking. What you been digging on, Don?
Well, I didn't know they still existed, but a band called the Melvins, who I kind of have a vague recollection of back in my 120 minutes days, but they're kind of pre-grunge, I guess.
Yeah, they've been around forever.
But they have a new album called Tarantula Heart.
Good title.
Yeah,
I like it.
Yeah, sounds very Melvins-y.
Not a bad thing.
Yeah, they've continued to just do their thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're in their own lane, 100%.
I think they have two drummers like Miles Davis.
You know what's really great about them? That they are not the Pet Shop Boys. That's my favorite. That's my favorite thing about the Melvins.
Yeah, well, you know, I heard that Pet Shop Boys record's coming out pretty soon.
I hadn't heard that at all. All right, so this time around, I stuck a little more, I guess, country Americana. So I stumbled upon something weird in one of the music services. Just the name caught my eye. It's the Brother Brothers. And the album is called the January album.
What is that? Are they brothers? Or?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
I like it.
Now, it's kind of bluegrassy, but it's also kind of Simon and Garfunkel-y with their harmonies. It's just super pleasant, and I think I'm going to listen to it a lot more. So that's
interesting.
Yeah,
it's... I think it's something. I think they got something here. And I don't think this is their first album or anything, but I'll definitely...
This is a new release?
Again, yes. Yes, it is.
Was it released in January?
I don't care. But it was called the January album. So good question. The next one I picked, I got some new records, vinyl records, and from episode 228 of the Album Nerds podcast, we got a little Marty Robbins, Gunfighter Ballads and Trail Songs. This is one of those times when, like, I'd heard some of these songs, but talking about it on the show, learning about it, listening to it, I had to have it. So I'm really glad to have that added to the collection. It's not like an original copy or anything. It's a new pressing, but
it's a classic, man.
I just love it when doing this show helps me learn to love something new.
It's really what we're all about. Learning to love.
Hope we do it for our listeners as well.
Okay, well, what are you digging? Let us know. Hit us up on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads at Album Nerds, or on our website, albumnerds.com.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
It's about that time on the show when I'm reminded of the great American novelist and poet Gertrude Stein, who said, "Repeating is the whole of living, and by repeating comes understanding, and understanding is to some the most important part of living."
Hmm.
With that idea in mind, let's bring out my friend and yours, Wadbot, to see what we'll be talking about on next week's show.
Boys, we did so much work here. So many double albums to experience. We're going to override the wheel, and we're going to go double on the double albums next week. We'll bring some more double albums to the table.
Doubling down On the double album Destiny?
Well, oh, you know, there were so, it was so hard to make choices. I figured let's just
double up.
I hear there's a new Taylor Swift to check out. Double album.
Oh boy.
All right, so we'll be listening to some more double albums of a double dose of double goodness.
Double your pleasure.
Well, what's your favorite double album? Have you listened to the new Taylor Swift yet? Let us know. Leave a comment on our website or email us at podcast@albumnerds.com. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads at Album Nerds. And please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app. And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so via PayPal at albumnerds.com/support.
Thanks for joining us on this double edition of the Album Nerds podcast. We'll catch you next week with even more.
Thanks for bearing with us, everybody. Catch you next week.
I got blisters on my fingers!
That's good.